Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Tuesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Today's guest is Matt Patain. Matt grew up in the area of Poughkeepsie and stayed there until his early 20s. He studied performing arts and moved to New York City to pursue a career in acting. After a few years in New York, Matt moved home after his mother had been diagnosed with cancer. During that time, he joined the Castaway Players and began performing with them. This included a New York City run of the musical Girlfriends from Hell. Matt also toured the country with his best friend, Frank McGinnis, a musician from Dutchess County. When Matt's mother passed, he moved back to New York City in order to continue performing. However, he began to become a little disillusioned with the acting performing industry and decided to move back home in order to figure out the next chapter in his life. He currently works at the Crafty Cup in Poughkeepsie and is deliberating over a potential return to school in the fall. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the Girlfriends from Hell.
yeah. So
in general,
I just want to hear more about it. You know, it was a personality types. Like there's this type and that type.
Well, it's mainly the one girlfriend. So it's a little bit of a nod to the old 80s camp horror films. So it definitely does not take itself very seriously at all. It's a rock musical.
Mm.
And it centers around a lonely, nerdy girl by the name of Maggie Miller, who just, you know, desperately wants to be loved. And of course, she has fallen for the star quarterback for the football team, who's dumb as rocks, who's played by yours truly.
Oh, and, did you play a dumb football star?
Oh yeah, yeah. And yeah, so essentially, she gets embarrassed at this party by Rocco, by his girlfriend, and so she just prays, she wants love, she would do anything for love. So Satan shows up, she sells her soul to the devil for love, and she becomes possessed and becomes like this rock and roll sex goddess. And systematically kills everybody that has wronged her throughout the show.
So literally from hell.
Yes. So yeah, from hell.
I take it this was off Broadway.
Yes. Yeah. we originally opened at the Gene Frankel Theater down in more of the like Lower East Side area. Right. Eventually, we ended up doing like concert performances as well, right on 54 Below. Like that, the large cabaret right off Broadway.
Right.
And then at the Cutting Room as well, which is a little bit further downtown. I think it's 42nd Street,
so,
maybe.
So how long did you do it?
I mean, I've been a part of the production through workshops and various performances, regional performances and things for about 7 years now.
Right.
The original run was only a few weeks. The concert performances were only like a single night thing, but we did original production actually in Rhinebeck back in 2013, I believe. And that one, that was a 3-weekend performance, 3-week performance. So it's been kind of on and off. I know for a long time, the writer of the show, who is actually the head of the Castaway Players, Sean Matthew Whiteford, he's actually local as well. He's originally from Saugerties. I think he lives in Hudson now.
This is where our radio show is, Hudson.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So him and his wife Judah live there, and I think he's been looking for a bit of a more permanent home for it for a while.
Right.
So it's just one of those things, you know. It's gone through a lot of different versions and everything.
Interesting.
Yeah. What first drew you to acting?
It's actually interesting because I didn't act or anything in high school.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't start until 2005. So I was a sophomore in college. It was always something that I had seen Broadway shows. My family would usually go down, much to the dismay of my brother and other relatives. But I always enjoyed it, and it got to a point where I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to audition for Pippin was the show they were doing at
Pippin.
Yeah, at Dutchess Community College. So I auditioned for that and I got into it. And it was one of those things
so,
that I just...
So what did you play in Pippin?
In Pippin, I was in the ensemble for the first production. Then after that, I got my first lead role in Songs for a New World, which is a Jason Robert Brown musical. He's done Bridges of Madison County
last five years.
A few of those, yeah. So I did that, and then from that point on, I was just hooked. You know, I got bit by the bug, I guess you could say.
Mike does some acting, don't you, Mike?
From time to time, I used to do more a little bit in college and stuff.
No, but I think you're a good actor, Mike.
Oh, thank you. That's how Andy and I met.
Yeah, we met. We both just moved into Greene County, and I was driving down the road and I heard an advert on the local radio saying, you know, come for auditions in the Greene County or the Greene Room Players.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I think I'll go there just to see if I can get a part, maybe meet some people.
Mm-hmm.
And I went along, and that's how I met Mike. Mike played Dave and I played
Mr. Richards.
Richardson. I owned a highly lucrative fishing lure company.
And I was the ad man that was trying to come up with the...
the hooky line or something. The advert for the some fishing lure promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Virgil's Christmas Catch?
Yeah, the local country bumpkin at the diner when Dave's character is like totally in dismay.
Because he can't come up with an idea. Yeah.
Goes to the diner, and then Virgil, like off the cuff, well, what if you did this?
Oh my God, brilliant. Dave. Mr. Richards. And we've been friends ever since.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
Lucky
us.
Lucky us, eh?
I'd say we're all lucky for it.
And now, come on now, this is a welcome to the Love Fest.
And I say that because your first song is Lucky Me.
Yes. So a little bit of a history.
Yeah. So who wrote the song and why have you chosen that one? To take to your cabin in the woods.
So there's actually multiple reasons why I picked this song. So the song is actually written by my best friend, Frank McGinnis. Who's originally from Roxbury, New York, in Delaware County.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Matt. No, not at all.
With the Roxbury Arts Group, I did radio shows. Phil Potek was a guest that we had. Yeah, he directed me in a lot of these, and a lot of great actors in Roxbury. What a cool area. A lot of really fun people.
Yeah, it's actually kind of surprising when people know about Roxbury. It's only about 500 people there.
it's very small.
Isn't that where you met... Thomas Courtney Clack.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he was also a voice actor in a lot of these radio plays and things. He's a great British voice, and he recorded sound effects for a living for years.
Actually, and, he actually recorded the sound effects for the toilet scene in Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it wasn't for that. He did that on his own.
Infamous toilet scene.
Yeah, it was used in the movie.
They stole it.
They stole it, yes.
Oh, no.
Well, that's what Tom says.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we digressed.
Yeah. So so Frank is here in Dutchess County. He is in Poughkeepsie. He's mainly operating out of there. Did a lot of shows in the area. A few years ago, he had written a musical by the name of Safe. Which is heavily inspired by the area in which he grew up. It's kind of about this this small mountain town in the Catskills, and it's a little bit of like a Boo Radley story. There's this character who has been living in his house for close to 60 years. And there's all these different stories about, you know, like, oh, I heard he's like this war vet, or I heard he kills people and hides them in the floorboards, you know, small town gossip kind of thing. But as the show progresses, the main character ends up working for him over the summer and kind of learns a bit more about his past. So in this this one song was written for the show, and so the one song was written specifically for the older character of Jim, which is the character that I played, the old man.
Yeah.
Well, there's it was
so
one of those.
You played a football star. Mm-hmm. You played an old guy.
Man. Yeah, it was 82 year old man, I believe. Yeah, the reason he didn't go with an older actor is because there are flashbacks that happen on stage where somebody's telling a story and it'll kind of go back to exactly what's happening, and then the actors have to be age appropriate. So this one song is kind of about how he had taken, you know, some time. He was a very like lovesick individual at one point, and he had taken some time to take a walk through the woods in his mountain town. And he kind of looked up and realized that, like, in the grand, you know, space of things, he's small, he's insignificant. And like this heartache that he feels is so inconsequential. And that there are far more important things in life. So the song is it's about how lucky he is that he's just alive, that he's part of this like grand world. And it kind of changes his entire viewpoint on life and love and exactly what somebody needs out of a relationship. And it was one of the songs that I sang in the show, and it just kind of holds a very special place.
Excellent.
In my heart.
I've waited and refused to budge. I gave up and renounced all love. For the first few years I refused to believe it existed. Then it happened, I was getting lost on purpose in the mountains of my town. When I stopped and looked around, oh gosh, how the trees are tall, and the sky is even taller. And look at me, I'm so small, and this heavy heart is even smaller. Lucky me, I get to drink and breathe. That sun's gonna rise again and give me a day to live in. And somewhere, girl, you get to have this world. And I don't think you want to keep it to yourself. I get it, I had thought a part of me left, but I still remained intact. And if I have me, there's nothing to lack. And there is no limit to the joy this life has in it. So I'm finding you again. We can live our separate lives hand in hand. For hours and 16 blocks, your address was in the phone book. And even if you slam the door, I'll at least get one last. Someone new, but I'm ready.
after we both grow, I'll be at your front door.
That was Lucky Me by Frank McGinnis. Now, Matt, you were telling us in your biography that you toured with Matt. Where did you go?
With Frank?
Sorry, with Frank, yeah.
You toured with yourself.
Yeah.
So Frank was originally part of a band back in the early to mid-2000s called Frankie and His Fingers. Bit of a pop punk band. They were together for a while, and then eventually he split off to do a bit of a solo project. His the first moniker he went by was Time Travels, and he had
wanted to make a fist of it.
What was that?
He wanted to make a fist of it.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So, anyway, sorry.
No, it's okay. So he had written a new album, which was a solo album. He played all the instruments and everything on the album itself. And he had booked a tour, and it was just going to be him kind of going around in his car and playing all these gigs.
Within New York or within the country?
Within the country, yeah. So originally he had asked me to go along, just kind of, you know, make a trip out of it, kind of a thing. And then as we were discussing it, he knew that I was a singer. This was when we had first started, when our friendship had kind of first started. So we hadn't really performed very much at all together. And he asked me to play a little bit of keyboard on about half the set, and sang some backing vocals and everything for the set. So we started in Brooklyn. We did our first show there. Went out to Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia. Did a show there. Then we went down to Baltimore. Then down to Washington, D.C. Then from there, we went to Johnson City, Tennessee, into Nashville. And then after Nashville, we went down and we spent about a week in New Orleans. Played a show down there. And then, New Orleans is just such an amazing city. We decided to stay a little bit longer. And then after it was all said and done, we were going to have one more show back up in Brooklyn on the way back. But unfortunately, I believe it was Hurricane Irene was hammering New York State at the time. So we had to cancel that show and just kind of head straight home.
Damn hurricanes.
Oh, I know.
Irene. But your next song is Bridge Over Troubled Water. And boy, nothing like it there during Hurricane Irene's. And why that song?
Mike is the segue king, just so you know.
Well, so Bridge Over Troubled Water, this was one that I had to think about a little bit. So it's actually the first album that I bought on vinyl. It was kind of as I was getting older and I was starting to appreciate music much
more.
Exactly. I had never really explored a lot of different genres of music, because, you know, when you're in high school and things like that, it's like you hear what's on the radio, you're influenced by your friends and maybe your parents a little bit. I had discovered Simon and Garfunkel very late in my life, unfortunately. And I think that to this day, Bridge Over Troubled Water is probably one of the greatest albums ever made.
Yeah.
And there's just something about it. It's like anytime that I need like some kind of like a pick me up, if I'm really just kind of
down
and out. Yeah. I'm feeling small.
You're not out. Yeah. You're just down.
Yeah. So I'll put on that album and just,
when you're weary.
Yeah. So I'll just listen to the whole thing. And it's just, I don't know. It was kind of between that and The Boxer were the two that I was really debating, but I just had to go with Bridge Over Troubled Water.
And the final line, "Sail on, Silver Girl," it was rumored in the public that that was about a hypodermic needle, you know, like a reference to drugs or something. But it was actually Paul Simon's wife had just started to notice some gray hair. So it's just about his wife. When you're weary, feeling small,
Was the fabulous Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel. Superb song, Matt. Thank you for bringing that.
Well, thank you.
Matt, you're going to bring a deck of Magic the Gathering cards.
Yeah. So for those who are not familiar with what Magic the Gathering is, it's a playing card game. It was developed in the early 90s. I think it was 1993 was the first set.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so it takes place in a it's like a whole fantasy kind of, you know, there's dragons and wizards and all this kind of stuff, and you're casting spells, and All it is, you know, there's a lot of math involved, a lot of resource management involved as well.
Wait a minute. It's a game of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's not like, you know, a bicycle, you know, poker cards or anything like that.
Are you a nerd?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right. I'm currently wearing a shirt that has a D20 on it. So yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah. It's a Dungeons and Dragons thing. We'll get to that.
Right. Sorry.
When I was a kid, Magic had just come out, and I remember kids bringing decks to school and playing a little bit and asking one kid, hey, how do you play? Could you teach me sometime? And he was like, no. you wouldn't get it. I was like, oh, man. So Magic to me has always been this really interesting but like totally unknowable thing. You know, I see these decks with this really cool artwork and these neat characters, and I'm into fantasy stuff, you know, Lord of the Rings and that genre. But, you know, you watch a game, and if you don't know anything about it, it's like, what in the world is going on? People are putting cards down and pulling cards out of a deck, and they're turning cards sideways. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
I have no idea what's happening there.
Let's kind of highlight my depth of knowledge in this game. the phrase Magic the Gathering is just new to me tonight. I've never heard of it. Literally never heard of it.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Just like a lot of other fantasy games that have.
When I was a kid, it was a thing called Top Trumps. You know, it was like Cars was one of the ones that we played, and your car had to be, you know, let's say there was like eight categories on the card: engine size and tire width and stuff. I'm making this up, but and if you chose one of the categories for your car that, you know, a great engine size, then if your engine size was bigger than mine, then you won that card. You know, and if it was lower, then I took your card, sort of stuff. Top Trumps. That's about the extent of a card game that I played that wasn't involving a 52 deck of cards.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so this one, it definitely got that reputation when it first came out, because, you know, Magic the Gathering sounds very, sounds like it belongs in the occult, you know?
Yeah.
So, so definitely there were a lot of people who, you know, didn't really know anything about it, this is the Satan game, like, I'm not gonna allow my kids to play this game, it's gonna teach them how to summon demons in my house.
And all the kids that couldn't get a girlfriend gathered in the corner of the playground.
It's true. And a lot of those
this game.
Well, that's not true. I couldn't get a girlfriend and I didn't play the game.
But you tried.
But the thing that you have to
teach me.
The people that jumped on it when it first came out are probably sitting on a small fortune who kept their cards. I mean, just a few years ago, there's this one card called the Black Lotus. It hasn't been printed in 20 years. It actually more than 20 years, but mint condition one sold a couple of years ago for just shy under $25,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a whole set called the Power Nine. It's the nine most powerful cards in Magic the Gathering. Generally mint condition copies of those go anywhere between 2,500 and 10 grand a piece.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Isn't
I have a bit of trivia for you gentlemen about the cards. When the deck was first released, they kind of they had developed these creatures and had artwork made for them, but the artists didn't really, they were given a name, but they didn't know like the powers of a creature or whatever. Do you guys, can you guess or do you know the infamous early Magic card that showed a bird in flight, even though the creature did not have the ability to fly? Do you know what that card was, what the creature was?
A phoenix.
Phoenix?
What the creature was.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. I'm not sure.
It was the Whippoorwill.
Oh, yeah. I definitely wouldn't have gotten that one.
The Whippoorwill.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't expect it. But that would be annoying. It's like, oh, this character must be able to fly. No. But,
yep.
But it's portrayed flying right there. Nope. Can't fly. Oh, come on.
Do you still have a pack?
Yeah, actually, I have quite a few cards. Yeah. I mean, I don't have
any expensive cards.
I mean, I have I have cards that are worth upwards of, you know, $100, $150 a piece, but, nothing really, too crazy.
I've still got my nude cards for the A's.
Well, heavens, man.
I first started playing 20 years ago in 1998. I think Urza's Saga or Urza's Destiny had just come out. It was one of the sets back then. And I started collecting cards. And then when I was in high school, I sold them all and bought a car. Well, at least, you know, put a down payment on a car. So I was driving, you know, a nice car and everything, and I got rid of most of my cards. And then in my like early to mid 20s, I was like, hey, this game was a lot of fun, and I kind of miss having my old cards. And of course, I looked up some of the cards that I had sold, and they're worth, you know, 10 times the amount that I sold them for back in the day. But that's what happens. So,
of course.
I started rebuilding a collection. I haven't gone too crazy with it.
Because you can't afford it.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the. I've seen bumper stickers that say like, you know, if you want your kids off drugs, like get them into Magic the Gathering, they won't have any money for drugs. but it's yeah. So it's something that I've enjoyed for quite a while, and you know, I do have a small collection, but not nearly as big as it was when I was a child.
Now, staying on the theme of quirkiness, mm-hmm. one of your next items is Dungeon Master's Guide.
Yeah, and that it sounds like a sexual thing, but it's not. it's for Dungeons and Dragons.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, which was created by our Lord and Savior Gary Gygax.
You're contributing to people's ideas that this is all actually based on
exactly,
the occult.
Exactly. It's just a little bit of a joke within the community. Mm-hmm. And so that was another one that when it first came out, a lot of people were very afraid of the connotations with the occult, and people, you know, thought. Same kind of thing with Magic the Gathering. They were assuming that kids were summoning demons because you could actually fight demons in the game. And actually, I believe it was the second edition they had come out with. They had actually taken the demons and the angels out and had given them completely different names. They still looked like demons and angels, but they wanted to kind of move away from that. And eventually, as people started to realize, like, oh, it's just a role-playing game. That's all it is. They brought everything back to the way it was. But I play in a group with my friend Julia from work.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. We play on Sundays, I'm also the dungeon master, who is essentially it's the storyteller. Essentially, the whole idea is that the dungeon master creates
2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You. Essentially create the world, this fantasy world that your players are in.
A woman looking just like you.
And all it is the players let you know what they want to do within this world. And you tell them kind of the situations that are happening around them. You know, sometimes they end up in confrontations.
Blindfolded?
No blindfold in this one.
Good heavens, man.
I'm going down a different road here. Your next song is Rocky Mountain High mm-hmm. by John Denver. Mm-hmm.
John Henry Deutschendorf.
Yes. not as much of a marketable name.
Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah, exactly. Jerry Dorsey, I believe, was his original name.
Yeah,
and they changed it to Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah. As you do, you know. So Rocky Mountain High mm-hmm. is your next song by John Denver.
Mm-hmm.
So why that song?
So this song is another one of those situations. It was actually the first time I remember I had found it in my mother's CD collection.
Right.
And I was like, oh, what's this all about? And I listened to it, and it was actually John Denver was the one who he's a little bit more country, but he kind of was like the bridge that led me into getting really into the folk genre of the 60s uh-huh. and 70s, because he's got a little bit of the folk inspired, a little bit more of a country twist to it. But And I actually was very surprised at how much I liked the music. And I remember there was one day where I heard my mother screaming at me from the top of the stairs, and I had the music blasting. I figured she was probably just telling me to turn the music down. She's like, "Are you listening to John Denver?" I said, "Yeah." So we talked about it, and it was like one of the first, you know, as like a as a young teenage boy, like my first conversation with my mother, where like, you know, you know that that time when you get older and you start to realize your parents are people.
Yeah.
And not just your parents.
That can fix everything. And,
yeah, exactly. You start to realize that they're just human beings that have lives as well.
Not super people.
Yeah, so she told me all these stories, you know, about how much she loved John Denver and everything. And it was kind of one of our first, like, moments where I was like, oh, you know, it's like
We like the same thing.
Exactly, yeah, which is interesting. And it's not like, you know, it wasn't something that was, like, forced upon me. It was just something that I found, and it was just a nice little connection.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away, on the road hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast, and it don't last for long. If the Colorado Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
He climbed Cathedral Mountains, he saw silver clouds below. He saw everything as far as you can see. And they say that he got crazy once, and he tried to touch the sun. And he lost a friend but kept a memory. Now he walks in quiet solitude, the forests and the streams, seeking grace in every step he takes. His side has turned inside himself to try and understand the serenity of a clear blue mountain lake. Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. Talk to God and listen to the casual reply. Rocky Mountain High. Of a simple thing you cannot comprehend. While they try to tear the mountains down, to bring in a couple more, more people, more scars upon the land. In the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. Though he'd be a poor man if he never saw an eagle fly. Rocky Mountain High, Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain fire in the sky. Friends around the campfire and everybody's high. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High,
That was Rocky Mountain High, performed by John Denver. You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acra. That's 90.7 FM. WGXC is community radio, so if you could give it any time by going to WGXC.org, it would help to keep shows like Catskill Cabin Conversations going. Today on the show, we have Matt Patain. Matt, thanks again for being here.
No, thank you.
You know, I've noticed with a lot of these items that you've brought, they come with some element of controversy. You know, Magic the Gathering, even in Dungeon Master's Guide with Dungeons and Dragons, even Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over over Troubled Water, people thought that it was about drugs. Mm-hmm. And your last item, second to last item, is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And I remember hearing in college, those were real spells. Mm-hmm. Real magic in Harry Potter, and, mm-hmm. and a big uproar about that. Of course, it's not. And now it's led to movies and sequels. And mm-hmm. So it's just kind of fascinating how there's this initial hysteria about things, and then people kind of cool off and realize, oh, this is just really great literature or really great music, and it's, mm-hmm. it's perfectly harmless.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of people just... And unfortunately, I think it's a big problem that you know is always been persistent, is that people learn about something, they learn about something on a surface level, and then before they actually look and figure out exactly what it is, they jump to a conclusion, and then sure. their mind is made up for a while. And it happens. I mean, it happens in politics. It happens all over the place.
Well, I mean, parents were saying about Elvis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Listening to that disgusting, that cretin gyrating his hips, you mm-hmm. know. And,
yeah. and he pops in from the future. Vump. Just wait. Vump.
So I picked up the first two books, and I read those, and I blew through them in maybe about 2 weeks. I actually distinctly remember after I had finished the book, I begged my mother to read it. I was like, you have to read this. And I actually remember her finishing the book, sitting in our, in a chair in our living room. And I was sitting on the floor, just staring at her, watching her finish the book so that I could talk to her about it as soon as it was over.
Did you discuss it with your mom?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she loved it. She only read the first one, so I don't think she liked it as much as I did. That's okay. You know, it's I would say it's a little bit more difficult for, you know, especially somebody who doesn't have a predisposition for liking fantasy novels to be reading a book that's intended for
children.
Children and like younger teens, and that's the other thing that I feel like with the series itself. Is why a lot of people, a lot of the millennials, really identify with it, is because the tone of the book does definitely change over the course from the first, because the first one is like this wild fantasy story about, you know, flying brooms and trolls and magic and everything. And then towards the end of the series, you're learning about how to like cope with death with like father figures and you know, the way that sometimes people manipulate children, and it gets pretty deep. And I think one of the reasons is because a lot of us were reading the books and they were maturing almost at the same rate that we were.
Right. I'm going to ask you some trivia.
Oh, sure. Okay.
What was, well, first of all, how do you pronounce JK's name?
JK Rowling, I believe.
JK Rowling.
Right. Just so you know, the name should be pronounced Rowling.
Oh, no kidding.
As in bowling.
Oh.
Right. So okay. JK Rowling. Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Say it after me.
J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling.
Thank you. Right. Now, what were the last words in the series?
The last words in the series.
In the Harry Potter series.
Can I guess?
Yes.
He was home.
Matt?
You'll be great.
All was well.
The same kind of feeling.
Rowling planned for a long time to make the last word of the final Harry Potter book Scar. At some point along the way, she changed her mind and wanted the final words to read All was well.
That's nice.
Yeah, I know that quite a lot of her was put into the book series as well. I watched a few interviews and everything, and She talked about how the Dementors themselves, the creatures who literally come into rooms and suck all the happiness out of the room and all the good memories and everything, were actually like an embodiment of the depression she was going through.
Yeah. She has another quiz question. She has a first edition book that sits on her bookshelf at home. What is it? Who is the author? I'll give you a clue. It's a woman.
Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged.
Just take a stab in the dark here. Mary Shelley, Frankenstein.
Oh, that'd be crazy.
Jane Austen.
Oh, that's nice. Oh,
okay.
Well, money is no longer a problem. J.K. Rowling has rarely splurged her money, but she bought an expensive book at Bond Street. And I just time to look, see how much it cost. I can't remember. I think it was about $1 million. But there you go. And she had childhood friends with the surname Potter.
No kidding.
While living in Winterbourne, just outside of Bristol, Rowling said she became friends with a brother and sister who had the surname Potter. She always preferred their names to hers and admitted that children used to tease her with nicknames such as Rolling Pin.
Hmm.
So there you are. Some little bits of facts.
Hmm. I do also know that the character of Dolores Umbridge is actually based on a woman that she actually knows in real life, of which they are not fond of each other. Oh. And apparently the woman who it is based on knows that it is based on her.
Awkward!
The game Quidditch, the sport of Quidditch, was triggered. The idea for it was triggered after a row with a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are.
Okay.
And one of the cafes, well, the cafe that she used to sit in and write, I don't know if she wrote the book there, but she did definitely write there, was called The Elephant in Edinburgh, which I have had lunch in probably about 5 times.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Scotland?
Countless times, yes. So I've been in this coffee house. I think it's in Nicholson Street. So there is a sign on the door or on the wall, you know, J.K. Rowling or J.K. I'm saying J.K. Rowling. Now.
Yeah, it's hard to
get it right, Andy. Jeez.
So J.K. Rowling wrote here, dined here, all that, you know. And then there's other coffee houses in Edinburgh that say J.K. Rowling never wrote any of our books here.
Wah, wah.
So there you are. Right, now your next song, Matt, we need to get moving on, is You Raise Me Up by Josh Groban.
Mm-hmm. So this one, a little bit of a sadder story for this one. So like I had said with John Denver, it was like the first time that me and my mother had realized that we, you know, had some common ground and everything. And she was very into Andrea Bocelli and Josh Groban and a few other artists. And I would frequently listen to, you know, Josh Groban with her in the car and occasionally sing along, you know, before I had really started performing and everything. So... Unfortunately, it was about 3 months before she had passed away. She had gotten tickets to a Josh Groban show, and she brought me to see him in New York City. It was the last... I mean, we had obviously had seen each other afterwards, but it was the last thing that the two of us did together, just the two of us. So whenever I hear the song, it, you know, it just reminds me of her, and it kind of, as cheesy and cliche as it sounds, it definitely does feel like she, is there helping me out and... You know, helping pick me up whenever I need it.
When I am down and oh, my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, then I am still and wait here in the silence. Yeah.
and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong.
Was You Raise Me Up by Josh Groban. Beautiful wee number, that.
Mm-hmm.
Good choice.
Thank you.
Obviously, sentimental song. Now, that song was has been recorded by about 157 artists.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah.
It's been hundreds of people. It's actually a song by Secret Garden, Irish-Norwegian duo. Mm-hmm. Lovely, lovely song. Right, we're coming to the end now of the show, but we have one more item that we need to discuss, and that's a book that you're taking with you to the cabin. Is it a movie?
Oh, no.
What is it?
It's a literal stuffed monkey.
I see. I actually thought it was the book.
No.
Oh, right.
Is there a book, Ishmael the Monkey?
Yes.
Oh, there is.
Is there? I know of Call Me Ishmael.
I've pulled out all this philosophical stuff about Ishmael, and I thought it's a bloody monkey.
It's literally a stuffed monkey.
Right,
yeah.
Tell us more.
So Ishmael, he wasn't named Ishmael initially. It wasn't until I was a little older before.
Well, you do know there was a book about the guy who goes into the house and there's a gorilla there.
Oh no, I'm not aware of that one. No,
right. No, I don't know that.
So that's why I thought.
No, I'm aware of, you know, Moby Dick, and there is a book called Call Me Ishmael as well, which is the opening line of Moby Dick.
Right.
But No, it was one of those things. So so Ishmael was a stuffed monkey puppet. Well, I shouldn't say was. He is a stuffed monkey puppet that I received on Christmas in 1987. Mm-hmm. It was like my second Christmas. He's actually 6 days older than my younger sister. And yeah, it's just it's one of those like small little sentimental things that like no matter how many times like I go through and I get rid of all my stuff whenever I move from place to place, I just don't have the heart to get rid of them.
To take Ishmael the monkey.
Yeah. Well, so
we actually had a guest on, Josh Fromer.
Yeah.
And he had a pet bear, you know, stuffed bear.
Oh, okay. I was like, an actual bear?
Yeah, up in the mountain.
That's way more interesting than a stuffed monkey.
And his mum threw it out and he like, where is it? So it's out of the sidewalk, mm-hmm. ready to be picked up in the morning. He was in the trash can, mm-hmm. pulled it out. Don't ever throw my bear out again. A teddy, he called it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we get sentimentally attached to things, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, he doesn't actually currently reside in my house right now. He's at my parents' house in a storage bin, because I've moved back and forth between here and New York City a few times over the last few years, and a lot of the times it's whenever I move back up here, I always start accumulating things, and then I move to the city and I go, I can't fit half of my stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't want to just get rid of it. It's like I just bought this like a year ago. So my parents' attic has a few storage boxes of a lot of my stuff. Mm. And Ishmael is in there. His arm is badly in need of...
Did he have a stroke?
I mean, it looks like it at this point. I mean, he's actually got
circulatory problems.
he's in surprisingly good condition, yeah. For considering he's 31 years old. But his, you know, his left arm is kind of hanging on by a thread, and you know, his face is getting a little droopy. So it does look like he just had a stroke. Yeah.
just give him some aspirin; he'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, we've come to the end, Matt.
Yeah, it's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
We just have one final question for you.
Okay.
How do you take your coffee?
This is gonna sound terrible. Considering I work at a coffee shop, I actually don't really drink coffee all that much. Andy is giving me this look.
Are you winding me up?
No, I'm serious. I am serious. I mean, I do occasionally drink coffee. I'm actually more of a tea guy myself.
Right. Does Tana know this?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. No, it's I do enjoy coffee. And when I do, I mean, I'd say probably it depends on the coffee as well. I mean, diner coffee, you got to fill that up with milk and sugar to just mask that horrible acid flavor. But like the coffee at the cup, usually I'll just a little splash of milk, maybe, you know, tiny little bit of sugar. But even then it's, you know.
Do you have a double espresso or a?
Oh, yeah. Generally, if I drink coffee, it'll usually be in the form of like a latte or an espresso or something like that. I very rarely drink drip coffee, but I do actually like French press.
Right, right.
But drip coffee is not really my forte, I should say.
Thanks again, Matt.
Oh, thank you. Hi, I'm Matthew Patain, and you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM. Special thanks to George, Gordon, and Billy from the band White for the theme music and to everyone at WGXC. Thanks.